This is an ABC podcast.
Hoax, you'll never guess what I got for free off Facebook yesterday.
How'd you get something for free off Facebook?
Look, I'm a member of this local group where people in this particular suburb in Hobart give stuff away to each other. It's really nice. And it said, free to a good home. Just come and pick it up off my doorstep. Here's the address.
Okay.
And waiting for me there was this.
No! No! Fucking way! No, no one gives that away. No, there is no possible conceivable world where someone gives away a Lego Millennium Falcon already built. And it's the one where the fucking things open up. Oh, no.
Yep, this is the one from episode 9. So it's got Rey in it and Chewie in it.
But it's got, this is where the lid, the roof opens up and it's got all the inside. No.
It's got all the characters with it. The gun swivels on the top.
So did you build it?
No.
It was built.
It was built.
Someone who builds a Millennium Falcon and then goes, nah, I don't want this. It's rubbish.
here's a cool thing that I don't know why it's there, but there's a bit at the front here that rotates out and turns it into the Kessel Run Falcon where it's still got the solid bit at the front rather than the forks.
Okay, this is ridiculous. I hate you. Okay, I know. I literally hate you, right? I was going to buy you a beer this afternoon, but no, you can screw that. No, I've got no words.
My wife said, oh, are you getting that for Hogan's birthday? I went, you've got to be kidding.
Your wife is a very intelligent woman, and I think that's a fine idea.
The only thing is, we've just reset our house. There's nowhere for it to live at my house, so it has to live at work.
It's about the size of your house, to be fair. This literally, I mean, your house is, like, tiny.
It has to live at work next to my Lego X-Wing, so the collection grows onwards.
I hate you.
You are listening to Nerdzilla, the ABC podcast made by nerds for nerds. The geeks in chief are Andrew Hogan and Joel Rheinberger. We're here today to discuss the Snyder Cut, the recent remake of the Justice League movie. But first, we'll have to get over this whole Lego thing.
There's got to be a story behind that Lego Falcon, mate.
I have no idea what it is. It just on the Facebook page, this is free to a good home, and so I have a good home. I think I have a good home. But
of
so
sorts, yeah.
They probably, you know, imagined it would go to a child, but that's not the truth. That's not what happened. It's going to me.
It sort of is the truth, actually. I thought, well, what I can't conceive of is somebody building it and then deciding to give it away.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it? And yet here we are, and I've got a very expensive piece of Lego now with all the people in it and all the little rotating bits on the top and the bottom and the legs that go up and down.
So I've got a theory, and I think it was like, remember I told you ages ago that my son bought like this that $160 belt-fed battery-operated rifle from the tip shop in Margate for $20, and I said to him, there's no way that works. Like, it's in the tip shop, you can't test it. Got it home, it's in perfect condition, including with all the bullets. So, I mean, it was more than $20 worth of Nerf bullets that we got with it. And I reckon it's one of those scenarios where, look, Johnny, if you shoot your sister with that Nerf gun one more time, it's going to the tip. And he did it, and it goes to the tip. Do you think it might have been one of those rage things?
Look, I don't think rage, because if you're enraged, you chuck it in the bin. You don't give it away on the South Hobart Good Karma Network.
Oh, yes, good point. Because that's so you've actively given it away. Yeah, good point.
I think maybe it is part of someone's collection, which is now taking up too much space.
Too much room. Yes, that's perfect.
And look, frankly, it takes up too much space for my house. It's bigger than a dinner plate, and so it's now living on my desk. I've cleared off part of my shelving around my work desk, so I have a place to put it.
Yeah, you've actually reached a point where you can't bring anything else home, can you?
Pretty much.
It really is.
Pretty much.
Because I can just keep filling my shed with shit, basically. It's terrible.
That's why every time we try and do something in your shed,
we can't.
We basically have to set fire to it and start again, don't we?
That would actually be the only thing that we really can do, to be quite honest. I was trying to find my chainsaw the other day after you came down and chopped a wood block, and I can't find it. Where did we put it?
I don't know. It's probably still in the wood block as far as I'm concerned. Is it sitting out? Did you just drop it and walk away? Did you do like a mic drop except with a chainsaw?
No. We left it on the veranda and then Mrs. Hogan did a veranda clean.
Right.
So that means it could
be
literally
anywhere.
So
there was a notice in the South Hobart Good Karma Network, free to a good home.
Still chainsaw. I should probably keep an eye on that for some of my things, shouldn't I?
Spoiler alert! Spoiler alert! In 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
We should talk about the reason we are here, which is the third giant piece of airtime we're giving to the bloody Justice League movie. The Snyder Cut hath arrived.
It certainly has.
How many times have you seen it now?
Five.
Five times. 20 hours of your life have been poured into Zack Snyder's Snyder Cut.
8 hours on the first day it came out. So watched it once, then timed it so that when my son Clark got home from school, it was just finishing on the credits. And he's going, "Oh, Dad, did you watch it without me?" And I went, "Yep, we're going to put it straight back on again, mate."
So I can tell you about all the good bits as they come up.
I didn't need to tell him. He was commentating the good bits because, and this is probably part of the review of the film, but one of the things that makes this film so enjoyable as a fan is that constantly through the movie, you'd say, "Oh, wouldn't it be awesome if XYZ happens?" And then literally the next minute, XYZ happens. Like everything you wanted to have happen at any time during the film, it seemed like Zack Snyder just knew this is what a fan would want.
And he had 4 hours in which to make it happen,
exactly.
So he did.
So he could do it. Yeah, look, and it's full of little wonderful little bits where, and also there was one part, the final battle with Steppenwolf. And he goes, "Dad, stop. Go back 30 seconds. So we're back 30 seconds. "Oh, you're awesome. Dad, stop. Go back 30 seconds again." I did it. And he did this 5 times. And I went, "Why do you want to keep watching this bit over and over again?" He goes, "Because I'm pretty certain Superman just kicked Steppenwolf in the penis." And then I watched it more closely. And indeed, yes, he did kick Steppenwolf in the groin. Go Supes. Nice. Look, it's the sort of thing that I think you can just go back to and watch again because it's so joyously designed for fans. It is 4 hours of fan service.
We should just lay it out for any nerd whose head has been under a rock for several years. So when Zack Snyder was making Justice League, he had a family tragedy and he just had to leave the production.
Mm.
So they handed it over to Joss Whedon. Joss Whedon rewrote chunks of it, had new bits of it acted, and then cut it down quite considerably from Zack Snyder's vision. And that's what got released in the cinema and on the original Blu-ray. But after fans have made noise about it on the internet for years, Zack Snyder spent $70 million
of HBO Max's money
to remake it the way he wanted it to be.
Now, I think it's worth doing a bit of a deep dive into what really happened because, and look, for those who want to go and find out, Vanity Fair online have a fantastic article called "The True Story of the Snyder Cut" because it isn't actually what we were first told that happened. Basically, Zack Snyder had made the entire film. The film was made. And it wasn't just made, it was edited. He was in absolute post-production. They were simply finishing off visual effects and things like that. And when his daughter died, he spent another couple of months with his wife, Deborah, who was a producer of the film, on the project, fighting with Warner Brothers about what they wanted for the film. So eventually he walked away because, in his words, he just got sick of fighting with them about this film. And Whedon had been brought in to write dialogue for pickups, and that just for pickups. Now, pickups are stuff that the editor says he needs to make a scene work, and he doesn't have any footage to actually make it work. You know, often when you're cutting a film, you don't realize till you're cutting it that you're missing this bloke walking from that room to that room, type of minor stuff. So Warner Brothers figure, okay, we've got Joss Whedon, made the first two Avengers films, Buffy, Firefly, fantastic. Let's get him to finish the film. And him, of course, had no baggage about the original vision for the film, so they could pressure him to do what they wanted, and he would do it. What they didn't realise, and this is the bit that stuns me, I would just love, someone needs to make a documentary about this, how this happened. He reshot 3/4 of the film. So the film that we saw in 2017 is 2 hours long, 1.5 hours of it, he was completely new footage. Now, at what point does a Warner Brothers executive go, hang on a minute, he's not doing pickups, he's making the film a second time. There is less than 30 minutes of Zack Snyder's footage in the theatrical release. So they basically paid for a movie twice. And it seems like incomprehensible that a movie studio where they are so concerned about making sure that every bit of money gets apportioned the right way could let him off the leash completely and then to admit, and there are quotes in this Vanity Fair article from executives from Warner Brothers saying that when they saw the cut that they got from Whedon, the quote was, "Well, that's a giant piece of shit, isn't it?" They knew that they'd paid twice for a movie and what they'd end up with was something that was garbage.
Because it was nobody's vision of what it was meant to be.
It was. It is boring. It is like you take the most perfectly cast ensemble film, because every one of those actors is spot on in their role, and make something that you just shrug your shoulders and go, "Well, what happened there?" Like, nothing.
This is not the spirited defence of the film that you gave me a couple of years ago when we first
reviewed it. Yeah. Here's another crazy thing. The special effects were rubbish.
Yeah, Steppenwolf just looked like a rubber man. It was terrible.
Well, no, and there was no reason for that. It was almost like, look, as we now know, Joss Whedon is garbage. Okay.
Yeah, Joss Whedon is officially a creep.
Yep, and one of the reasons we know that is from actors from Justice League. But I just think that at no point does it look like even he cared. I think he was just like, I'm in the right place at the right time. I'm going to do the minimal amount of work. And because I'm getting paid. Wonderful story about how Christopher Nolan was executive producer on it. He went and watched the film, the final cut of the theatrical release, with Deborah Snyder. And they both agreed that they would both go back to Zach and say, "You must never watch this film." They just felt that it would, like, the fact that
he'd be offended.
Yeah, his name is on it as director, and that he would be so upset at what ended up on the screen. And to this day, he's never seen it, which is... again, amazing.
And he has kind of done back to Whedon what was done to him, in that he's discarded every single shot of Whedon's, hasn't he?
Every single shot. Yes, that's right. I think the percentage is that there's 12.5% of the film is what we've already seen.
The question for me is, if the film was 99% made, what did they spend $70 million on?
Visual effects, basically. That's not a big expense for digital effects and things like that, because apparently none of that was done for him. Zack Snyder, before he left, the final thing he did was downloaded the entire film to his laptop and basically stole it and took it home. And the entire aim, he's basically said, look, what he wanted was a copy of the film, and it was black and white copy to keep the file size down with no visual effects. But he wanted to have something he could show to a mate in 10 years' time who's come around for a beer, and he'd say, "Look, this was the film I really wanted to make. Remember that film I made in 2017?
Yeah,
this is what it was meant to look like." The existence of that cut is the reason that HBO Max were willing to go as far as they did, because it was sitting there. It existed. It just needed tidying up.
Was the actor who played Steppenwolf the same in the two versions?
Well, Steppenwolf on film is entirely CG, but yes, it's the same actor. Karen Hines doing his voice, yeah, same.
Completely different character.
Yeah, but they also put sound effects on his voice that are different.
Yeah.
He was very passive in the theatrical cut. He was like very, he sort of did that whole, "I'm really bored with this. I don't have to kill more people. I've got to go and buy a pack of chips from the milk bar."
He was like a dog who had been hit too many times.
Yeah.
Was what he was like. He was cruel and angry and warlike, and yet he was cowering in front of Darkseid when that stuff came up. He had so much character to him, and he had almost none in the original theatrical release.
And he was so spiky.
Oh, the movement of the spiky armor suddenly makes sense of that armor. You just go, wow, how frightening would that be to fight against someone with armor that is trying to bite you the entire time?
And he had a motivation. Like, he didn't care about the mother boxes or the anti-life equation, but he needed to get back into Darkseid's good books. That was it. Darkseid is so important to the New Gods universe, to Apocalypse, that the point at which Desaad says, "No, you have to conquer 50,000 more worlds," and he's like, "I will do it for Darkseid, whatever it takes. But, oh, by the way, the anti-life equation is not on this planet, so you might want to think about that.
We'll just reduce that by 49,999.
Yeah. I have a theory that Steppenwolf was a bit angrier in this version, because you really can't hug him. Because that'd hurt.
Well, you can, because there's that bit where the armor comes off.
Oh, that's, yeah. You can only hug him if he's nude. He's got to nude up for a hug. Now, that's not very COVID safe these days. Okay, you can't be doing that stuff anymore. Yeah.
What do you mean anymore? How often are you nuding up for a hug, Hogan?
Oh, back in the before times, we used to do it all the time. Come on, you were there. I was there. Yeah, it's a Saturday night.
All right, let's talk about what is different between the two cuts. Mm. I think. a great amount of levity has been taken out. Whedon, you know, deliberately put in spots of good humour, and there was a couple of spots of good humour that I really missed.
I missed none of that. I thought it was all stupid, snappy dialogue that just made no sense in a Zack Snyder film. It was the whole, you know, Batman getting punched by Superman and go, oh, something's definitely broken. It's like, no, he just wouldn't say that. That just would not happen. Cyborg saying, booyah. It's like, mate, if I wanted to watch Teen Titans Go, I'd watch it with my kids, okay? I don't want you to be saying that stuff. But what also surprised me was that the humour that was left in, which is clearly Snyder stuff,
yeah,
proves that he still knows that you need those sort of things in films. I think that when you watch the theatrical cut of Justice League, it's actually the humour stuff that jars. And so I didn't miss any of that.
So there was a couple of humour bits, like when Cyborg and Flash are digging out the grave, and they realise that they've got the job of doing the digging because they're the new guys.
Mm.
That was really funny. It's otherwise the same scene, but it had a really fun little insight into their own figuring out where they fit.
There's one line in that, in the theatrical cut, that I did like, and it's that when one of them says, because we're the accidents.
Ah, yeah, that's right.
You see, they're not superheroes by choice or by fate or whatever.
Yeah,
They are literally accidents. And oh, look, okay, I would have allowed that one, but the rest can go jump.
Also, the point where Batman tells Flash, just rescue one person. I actually thought that in the original was really lovely. It was really powerful, and that he rescued one and then another, and just doing one good thing led to every other good thing that he did in the entire movie. And I thought, again, great line and a really great moment of the movie. And I was a little sad to see some of those Whedonisms were really worth having, I think.
Except there was a narrative reason for that, because in the theatrical cut, we really have no idea how experienced Flash is. We have no idea whether he's even done anything at all. Whereas in the Snyder cut, we see him rescue Iris from the car crash.
Yeah.
And he's clearly very competent at what he does. So to have him admit that, you know, you've done battle, I've never done battle, blah, 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 wouldn't have made a lot of sense, because he clearly has control of his powers.
Plus, if you're the Flash, you don't really need to be afraid of battle.
Well, no.
Nothing can touch you, frankly.
Exactly. You can just run away.
When I was a kid, that's, you know, let's play superheroes. I'm going to be the Flash. And they go, I shoot at you. Well, it doesn't work. I phase through it.
Yeah.
I scoot around it. Anything you do, I don't care.
I run to Italy and back for fun. Yeah, true.
And I come back with a crowbar.
Which actually brings me to one of the most great things about the fact that the film was essentially unlimited, was that we got fantastic backstory on Cyborg and Flash. Because we don't need backstory on Superman and Batman.
No,
or Wonder Woman. We,
no.
We really don't. But, you know, Ray Fisher was amazing as Cyborg. His Vic Stone held the film together, because he wasn't just the accident. He didn't even want to be who he was. And he's dealing with his mother dying and his dad being absent, yet his dad saves him. And there's a whole lot of stuff that the journey he went through as a character really held it together for me.
Yeah, very much expanded that. We also got to see the journey of Lois Lane, of grieving and finally letting Clark go, and then he reappears in her life and the complications of her emotions, which was nice to get a little bit of that depth, that she's not just a side character, she's the centerpiece of his life.
Mm.
She's kind of his reason for living in so many ways.
Well, and of course was going to be the actual centerpiece of the sequel, which we're never going to get. From the nightmare future, the whole save Lois thing. So we needed more Lois Lane in this film, because Lois dying, causing the nightmare future where Darkseid takes control of Superman, was literally going to be the next movie.
Is that definitely not going to happen? Or would you think the fact that this has been so popular that it was crashing servers of streaming services may change their minds about that?
So Warner Brothers have interestingly come out and said, in response to a direct question from a journalist, that the theatrical release is canon and this is not. This is Elseworlds as far as they're concerned. However, you're right. This has created a rolling ball that is growing and growing and growing. I mean, this has done something that I'm sure they never expected this to do.
And the thing about saying this is Elseworlds and that's canon is that can be reversed just by them saying so.
Correct. Well, but also they've clearly admitted, I mean, we're getting a Robert Pattinson, Batman, Matt Reeves trilogy that is outside of the DCU. So fantastic. So, I mean, I think the whole shared universe thing is overrated in films. You know, Venom as a film worked, and we don't have to know that then there was no Spider-Man in Venom, but great fun film.
They're overrated until they work, until you get Avengers Endgame.
Okay.
And go, wow, that is an amazing thing. And and all the emotional beats in that film that only happen, you know, this character's on film in this movie for all of a minute and a half, and yet there's a big emotional beat because of the shared universe. I think that's kind of skipping over it a bit to say that they're overrated, because I think you can make them work. It just takes the will and the producer and the right set brain to force them to work.
But you don't have to. My point is that you don't have to. And absolutely what Marvel did is fantastic. This film, though, Zack Snyder's Justice League is the reverse of Avengers Endgame in that it's a single film that sets up at least six sequels.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you can literally, the way that he ended it, there could clearly be six completely separate films coming out of that one storyline. The fact that, you know, we're not going to get Batman versus Deathstroke, it's just, oh, you know, for me, that would have just been supreme. Affleck's Batman versus Joe Manganiello's Deathstroke, the way he was portrayed in this cut, oh, that just would have been phenomenal.
See, I could see most of those stories being wrapped up in another four-hour movie.
Yeah, totally.
But I guess there's the thing. Can you do a four-hour cinema release?
Apparently, this film has had cinema release in certain parts of the world where they have an interval after 2 hours, 20 minutes.
See, that's what should happen. You should be able to have a movie this long. You just have to have an interval.
You've got to go and get a choc top, don't you?
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's right. So, here, interesting thing, Joel. This is the first, I mean, I can't think of a time or a film where we have literally seen the version of a film that the filmmaker wanted to make when the version that actually came out was completely not what he wanted to make. I mean, the closest, I think, is probably Francis Coppola's Apocalypse Now, the Redux version, where Redux was the edit that he did, where he went back to the original raw footage and made the film that he would have made if he hadn't had the time constraint and the money constraints of the studio. Because as you know, Apocalypse Now was famously, you know, overran in costs and everything about it was a disaster, and Marlon Brando was the size of a cow. Then they also killed a cow in the scene they killed him. That was a bit confusing for me. But anyway, the point being that Redux is a very, very different film, but it's the same director. You know, this is an example of what we saw is actually what they call in Hollywood an assembly cut. So to break it down, an assembly cut is the cut of a film that a director shows to the studio where he takes nothing out. He just edits it for, you know, mistakes and things like that. But an assembly cut is not edited for time. So they often go for about 4 hours. And basically the studio executives watch the assembly cut with the expectation that probably half of it's not going to make the cinema release. Yeah. But it's so they get an idea of the story. So they get an idea of what the acting's like, what the plot's like, and what the actual...
What's working, what's not working.
Yeah, what the feel of the film is. And literally this is this. This is an assembly cut because he took nothing out. If he filmed it and intended it to be on, it's on. And I think that's fantastic because we don't get to see that very often.
I think it could have done with some editing. I think 4 hours is too long. And there are things that took 10 minutes that could have taken two.
Oh, no, there are things that took 15 minutes that could have taken 0 minutes. I love that. I literally love the fact that I got to see everything that Snyder committed to film that he thought was worth seeing. Case in point, wonderful scene where Diana's in the Batcave and Alfred's pottering on the Batmobile and she's on the computer doing something, playing Galaga or something. And she says, I'm going to make a cup of tea, Alfred, would you like one? And he says, no, Miss Prince. And he hovers around her telling her how to make the tea because he's so goddamn English. Like she's 5,000 years old and he's like, oh, put the water in first, Miss Prince. We don't want to scald the tea. And then she goes to do something else. Make sure we sleep for 3 minutes. Like, he can't help himself because even though he doesn't want a cup of tea, he can't stand to actually, as an English butler, you couldn't stand to see someone make a cup of tea not the way it's supposed to be made. Now, that drove no part of the story, literally, but it was beautiful.
It was a lovely little piece of character.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were so many of those bits that I'm happy that I saw. Now, you know,
what did you think of the opening, which is Superman screaming as he's killed? And that scream, we literally go with the wavefront of the scream as it reverberates around the world and, you know, goes to Atlantis to everywhere else around the world.
The scream woke up the mother boxes. See, there's a scene in the film where Victor Stone's dad wakes up a mother box to turn Victor into Cyborg, and that doesn't summon Steppenwolf because Superman still is alive on the planet. The mother boxes know that there's a Kryptonian on the planet. The moment Superman dies, all three mother boxes wake up because the planet is no longer protected. And that's why. And so that gives so much context that was missing in the theatrical cut, where it's like, if they know these things, like Steppenwolf in the original movie knows that the mother boxes got left on Earth and he got taken back to Apocalypse, so why didn't they just go back the next week and get him back again? I mean, it's like, what were they faffing around doing other things?
Yeah, one of them was just buried in a hole and deep hole.
I just love the Atlanteans, bottom of the oceans, guarded by dudes with energy weapons, and the Amazons have just got it in this giant jail full of weapons, and the humans just chucking a shallow grave in the jungle. Because we really don't try.
Good one, Barry.
Hard.
Good work.
Were you the same bloke that got that boat in the Suez Canal? I mean, come on. So I like that, because what he was trying to get at is that Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice literally starts at the end of Man of Steel. It starts at the battle with Zod, and this film starts at the death of Superman, which is the end of Dawn of Justice. He really wanted them to be very closely linked, which really worked for me, but it gave context to the whole, why did Steppenwolf and why did Darkseid not come back sooner? It's because they were shit scared of Superman, basically.
I didn't like the fact that Martian Manhunter makes a ridiculous cameo. That could have been completely painlessly cut. It was completely aside from the movie. At least the Alfred and Diana bit fit in the storyline. Mm. It was just bullshit and unnecessary. I thought they should have got rid of that.
You know that was not originally Martian Manhunter. That was a Green Lantern originally. So when Bruce wakes up in the lake house and some guy floats down from that was originally, Affleck filmed that scene, obviously to nobody because it's all done with CG, but yep. He filmed that scene. The expectation was that was a Green Lantern from Oa, and they decided to change it up for this one. I liked it. I love seeing John Johns on film. It's fantastic.
Look, I would like to see John Johns on a film in which it has some meaning this was just completely nothing.
No, but he's been living on Earth as General Stanix for however long because he wants to stay hidden, and he's now seen that now there's...
All of these things can be in another movie.
Yeah.
Because it was so short and I just found it pointless and it didn't add to the story in any way. So I just reckon it's fan service, but it's nothing else but fan service. Mm. That's all that moment was, I reckon.
I just thought it gave context to now that there is a superhero group together, here's a superhero who's been living on Earth among us, hiding because he doesn't feel he can, you know, show himself, and now he feels that he can. I thought that was great.
I did like the fact that we actually got much more of a battle with Apocalypse.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't just Steppenwolf and Darkseid is kind of a mystery in the distance. It's actual, here's Apocalypse, here's Desaad. You even get a glimpse of Granny Goodness
yes.
In the background there. And here's Darkseid. The technology, the kind of living stone thing which transforms into as a little message board thing.
That worked so well.
Was marvelous. Well,
their version of Skype.
Yeah,
it was their Zoom. It was their Zoom meeting. They have Boom Tubes and they have Zoom Tubes. Yeah.
So look, that was really great. And the fact that it actually came down to a proper battle against the forces of Darkseid and Darkseid himself, rather than it just being kind of Steppenwolf and who is he? Where is he from?
Yeah, that's
correct.
That
really filled the story out. That really made much more sense of what was going on, I thought.
And exactly the same as the flashback battle between the Atlanteans, the Amazonians and the humans with the original Darkseid battle.
With Zeus throwing his lightning bolts around. How good is that?
Good was that? And there was Ares was in there. And now here's a weird bit. David Tulis gets credited. So he played Ares in Wonder Woman.
Yep.
All right. He gets credited as Ares in this film.
Yeah, his face is there, isn't it?
Yeah, but he doesn't have any... He doesn't talk. Ares doesn't talk in the Snyder Cut, yet he still gets a credit. And he really only did a motion capture and the actual... Like he did nothing. That's a pretty good credit.
Oh, that's a fantastic credit.
He wouldn't have had to turn up. Like the CG guys literally did that, and they ring him up in his agent and says, you're going to get some residuals from this film. And he goes, what film? I'm sitting at home having a cup of tea. Yeah, but it was good, though, that scene. And the discovering the anti-life equation etched into the earth, you know, it gave it all such much more meaning.
I'm curious as to how a non-DC lover is able to cope with it. Like for me, who's been a longtime fan of the two major comic brands, no problem. And finding Antilife has a deep meaning to me.
Yeah.
It's enables Darkseid's zombification of the entire universe. I don't know if it looks like anything more than just some doomsday weapon to someone who doesn't have that background.
Look, it's the Infinity Gauntlet, basically, if you don't have that background.
No, the Infinity Gauntlet is explained within the movies.
Oh, yeah.
That he can remove half the life with a snap of his fingers.
It's still a MacGuffin, though.
Look, it is a MacGuffin, but it's explained. Whereas the reason that the anti-life equation has such an impact is because you know it means it allows him to erase your will and to make you a slave. I don't think that's ever actually explained in the movie.
It is in it. It does. Now, there is definitely, it's brief, but there is definitely dialogue where they explain why Darkseid is obsessed with the anti-life equation.
Well, he says it'll enable me to conquer everything, but it doesn't quite have that level of detail. Whereas, you know, the Infinity Gauntlet was, he's going to kill half the universe with it with a snap of his fingers. It was laid out exactly what it meant and how horrifying it would be, which is why it had the impact. So, look, I'm really curious if there's someone who's not a DC fan, who's not a big reader and doesn't know the fourth world characters very well, did the anti-life equation make sense to you? I'd be really keen to hear what you thought about that.
My son was cool with it. He has not read any Kirby fourth world stuff at all. And he said, oh, so daddy's, would that let him turn everybody into parademons? And I'm like, yeah, effectively that's exactly right. So he got it. It was, I'm glad they didn't dwell on it too much. And let's face it, the Avengers films had 21 movies beforehand to build up to it. So they had a bit of space.
Well, look, if you're going to put together not just the Justice League, but the fourth world in the one movie, you've got to spend the time explaining what the heck's going on and who the heck people are.
Hence 4 hours. Now, what did you think about dividing it up into chapters? I like the chapter concept.
Yeah, absolutely. It gives you a spot to pause and have a pee.
Yes, the width for you, very, very important.
I know with my tiny, weeny little bladder, that is important. But it also was kind of natural that, you know, I watched 2 hours in one day and then one of those came up and I looked at my watch and went, okay, it's bedtime. I've actually got to get up early tomorrow morning. And I actually found that quite helpful on that level.
Yeah.
And it gave me a place to come back to. But it's also just quite nice. Most human fiction is divided into chapters, into small bite-sized chunks, so you can come and go as you will. So I quite like that.
Well, one of the discussions that Snyder had with HBO Max was the fact that they know that these days it's absolutely common for someone to binge on 4 1-hour episodes of a TV show when they all drop at once on their station or Netflix or whatever. So a 4-hour film was not a big deal. Because we literally, people do commonly sit there and watch 4 hours of something that you've really been hanging out for.
Yeah, yeah.
And but to put it in chapters was nice because it compartmentalized it and it made it, yeah, like you said, easier to dice it up and you could go and get a drink from the fridge and some chips and stuff like that. That was pretty good.
It's long been my thesis that the sort of person, and I include myself of one of these, the sort of person who likes to get lost in another world likes to get lost there for a long time. Hence the giant size of most fantasy books. And it's because we enjoy being in this other place. So I think absolutely that length can work when you can divide it. I don't know how much I would have loved that movie if I'd had to watch it in one sitting at a cinema because you just get tired. Your eyes get tired and you get tired of keeping up with it. So I don't know how much I would have enjoyed that in a cinema situation, whereas watching 2 hours one night and 2 hours the next morning, I found really enjoyable. And look, I should say that this is a vastly improved film. I enjoyed this movie. It's so vastly improved from the original. Like I've been nitpicking just to provide a little bit of context and contrast to you, but I actually really enjoyed the movie. It hung together so much better than the Whedon one did.
Correct. The story hangs together. At no point are you ever puzzled about someone's motivation in this film.
Yeah, and the tone is consistent throughout. There are moments of levity, which I'm quite surprised at because so many of Snyder's films are completely free of any sort of moment of joy. And this had a few little moments of joy and levity. And we still got Barry Allen's character being kind of a slightly bumbling twit. Very, very smart, but I really need friends.
Mm. Ezra Miller is remarkable.
Isn't he just?
He really is, and he brings it to every role that he's just so Ezra Miller. And, you know, that was – there's a couple of things people forget now. It's been 4 years. Bold casting, him and Jason Momoa. You know, to make Aquaman a Polynesian, Hawaiian, you know, Pacific – dark-haired, long-haired, hulking guy, not a white guy with blonde hair, was a big deal because he was unlike anything.
It's just reversing what's been done to Jesus over the years.
Pretty much.
You know, Palestinian Jew from 2,000 years ago, and he's blonde everywhere.
Yeah, white, with long hair, and basically, except not Jason Momoa. Less tattoos than Jason Momoa.
So he's gone from what he really was to look more and more like Aquaman over the years,
That's
Jesus.
That's a good point.
And Aquaman has become more and more to look like Jesus.
But I don't think Jesus ever had a harpoon on his hand at any stage made by Star Labs.
You never know.
Would have been cool, though. Imagine
I'm
that.
Sure there'll be a comic of that coming out.
Probably.
There's half a dozen comics of Jesus now.
Speaking of which, I thought that Momoa had a lot more to do, and the opening scene, the introduction of him with Bruce, was much more interesting.
Yeah.
Even though fundamentally you felt like, if you weren't paying attention, you felt like you're watching the same scene, but you weren't. That dialogue was very, very different. Like the reveal that Bruce could understand their language.
Yeah.
That was just nice. The fact that, you know, $5,000, I'll pass the message on. I'll give you $25,000 right now to talk to him, despite the fact that Bruce clearly knows it's him and gives away the $25,000 anyway, because who cares? And you also get much more of the Aquaman Arthur going, so what, you do it literally dressed as a bat? Yeah. Yep. 20 years.
I really loved the women singing at the shore as he went in.
The Enya cover band.
And one of them picks up the jumper and smells it. She's clearly in love with him.
Yeah.
Really beautifully done moment of emotion. Again, things that I don't expect in a Snyder film.
No.
There's a beautiful little moment of emotion there and she has no name.
Yep.
And her voice cracks and she stops singing to have this moment to say goodbye. And then she joins in the singing again. And that song comes back again later in the movie.
She
as well.
Likes that Arthur Musk though, doesn't she? And he only had that jumper on for about 2 minutes.
That's
man.
Right. That's right. He really, you're Aquaman. You got the stank full time.
He must exude
well,
it.
Well, you know, all the animals that eat fish full time, Andrew,
oh, good point.
They stink.
Yeah.
Have you ever been out near one of the rocks where seals live in Tasmania?
No, I have not.
Or where been to a penguin rookery?
Oh, I have indeed.
Oh, yeah, man.
That's good. That good point. They
don't
smell.
There's a full-on stench around those places.
You're saying Jason Momoa stinks?
Aquaman stinks.
Let's hope he doesn't listen to this podcast.
I'm going
to
separate him from Aquaman. Aquaman stinks,
good,
I reckon.
Because otherwise
smells a bit fishy.
You'd be in trouble. But you're right, that scene, and I'd love it, it comes back again, you know, so dress as a bat, okay? You know, because it is absurd. I love when characters call out the absurdity of the concept of Batman. Because it's like the whole point, and what Affleck's character really does well is, if you're a billionaire and your parents get murdered and you want to get rid of all crime in your city, you fix public housing, fund healthcare, give everybody jobs, fund the police properly, have community services working. You don't dress up as a bat and punch bad guys one at a time. That's the dumb choice. Like, that's the slow way of doing
it. For the man who's meant to be like, you know, what, the third smartest Batman in the DC universe. Yeah.
And I love it on film when characters call Batman out on the, you've really made a poor life choice here, buddy. And I mean, it's why Lego Batman's so good. Because in Lego Batman, every other character looks at him and goes, weirdo, like, this is not, it's a stupid thing that you're doing, and he doesn't get it. And so for Aquaman to publicly call him out is fantastic. But then we also got that just a tiny little bit more J.K. Simmons as Gordon.
Yeah.
Because I just thought that was
he's
such,
fantastic.
Isn't he? He's fantastic in everything he's in, but he was inspired casting as Gordon. And, you know, he's that line about, you know, how many of you are there? And it's like, you know, it's just, he's just, he doesn't, nothing surprises him. World weary, you know, Cyborg shows up, Aquaman shows up, and he's like, okay, well, this is what the world is. This is what I've got to work with.
I was very pleased to see, though, that it was actually Snyder's moment of the Flash going, oh, they've really just disappeared.
When they all disappeared.
Rude.
Yeah. I love the fastest man alive. He's the one who doesn't run away. Yeah. And actually, you've brought out a really interesting thing. Wasn't it nice that now we know which bits were Snyder's? That was great, because there were some parts of the original film where you thought, that's really good, that little nugget, that little scene, and now we know who made it.
Here's one bit, actually, that was taken out that I did miss, which was Batman tying up that thief in order to make him fearful enough that it would attract a parademon.
See, I thought that was stupid.
It was a pretty cool scene, though.
No, it's stupid. And then the
I'm willing to bet you didn't say that in our original review.
Correct. I'm a complete hypocrite. Don't worry. I know. Okay. If I'm going to go back in time and find 2017 me and go, you're a dick. No. Look, that scene, unfortunately, Whedon couldn't help himself but the fact that the parademon self-destructs and magically leaves an imprint of three mother boxes on the wall of the building.
Yeah.
Stupid.
Yeah.
That's stupid, okay? We literally, in the film that we just saw, we got introduced to the concept of the mother boxes. We got told what they were, what they allowed you to do, and why. We didn't get a stupid tattoo on a wall from an exploding... I mean, parademons don't self-destruct. What's that about? That's stupid.
Now, I do have to come to my single major objection to this movie, Andrew, which is that it was released in 4:3 format.
Oh, please, can we go there? Because I've been so wanting this.
Why, Andrew? Okay. What is the logic? Before I start screaming, what is the logic of releasing a movie to home televisions in 4:3 format?
Okay, I'm going to start and I'm going to tell you exactly the reason behind it. And there was a number of things, but the biggest one was because that's how he shot it. He shot it in 4:3. The raw tape, the raw file was a 4:3 format from the very beginning. And you can...
Is that because it was shot for IMAX?
Yes. And you can tell this because when Whedon gets onto the film and decides it's going to be 16:9 cinema aspect ratio, he had to...
It had to be anyway, didn't it? Because releasing in a normal cinema, you're not going to show it in the box shape of...
Yes, they were. They were. Absolutely. I've read the interview. Snyder said, we shot it in 4:3 and that's how it was going to be shown. And Whedon, of course, didn't want to do that. Warner Brothers decided they didn't want to do that. So when Whedon used footage that Snyder had shot, he had to enlarge it and lose the top and the bottom to get rid of the black bars at the side. And you can go back and watch the theatrical cut and there are some scenes where we seem to be oddly zoomed in, too zoomed in for what we really should be. So first thing, that was what it was made in. So he went to HBO Max and said to them, you realize I've shot it in 4:3, and they were fine with it. So the TV station's fine with it. He made it like that. But also he felt that, you know, that would be an interesting and different thing to do, to make it more square, to allow the scene to be almost vertical video, to allow him to... So when he shot it, when he was blocking off shots, he knew he was planning to do it that way. So you may not like it, but it was an artistic choice he made from the beginning. It wasn't something that happened in post-production for this Snyder Cut. It was meant to be that way.
See, I got taught by the ABC to shoot video more than 15 years ago.
Which is why you work in radio now. You must have been really good at it.
Look, I was doing a lot of web production and stuff as well as radio early in the piece. We were all expected to be mega multi-skilled and it was something I could do. So I did a course within the ABC and the thing that we got taught back then was called shoot and protect. And so what you had on your screen was a 16:9 box and a 4:3 box inside it. And so the job of someone who is making video for that purpose, for that screen, is to shoot it so it works for both, because it's going to end up on both. Some people will have one, some people will have the other.
And my argument there is that what you're doing is you are compromising your artistic vision to basically cope with those two scenarios. You know, you're going to set up a shot that you might not have otherwise set up if you were only shooting in 16:9 or only shooting in 4:3. And I don't have a problem with black bars on the side of my television.
See, I do, because it reduces the total visual impact of the movie that you are watching at home.
What if you sat closer? Then it would be bigger. Put your glasses on.
You know it's going to end up on a 16:9 television.
Yeah.
You know that's where it's going to be watched. In fact, that's where most of it is going to be watched these days. Mm. That it's going to end up on streaming services, that it's going to end up on home video of all sorts of various sorts. It's going to end up eventually being shown on free-to-air television, and it's all going to be broadcast in 16:9.
Oh, yeah.
You know it's going to be there. I know it's slightly different to your artistic vision, but I actually am very firmly of the opinion that you can stick your artistic vision up your ass.
Did you hear that, Mr. Snyder? Up your ass, specifically. All 4 hours of it.
That artistic vision, you know it's not going to work when it gets to the end place, the end product.
It did work.
See, it did not work as well as having it cut for 16:9.
No, it did work.
It just didn't.
I need an objective reason why it didn't work.
Because you're not filling up the visual field. The 16:9 screen is designed to actually fill the human visual field in a particular way.
That's not even remotely true.
No, it is. It is. It just seems madness to me that you're not filling it up. It's madness.
It was an arbitrary decision made by when cinema was invented. That's not how our eyes work. I'm serious. That's not how our eyes work. The fact is, they could not make 4 hours of a film that was originally shot in 4:3 into 16:9 and make it not look shit. It would have been terrible. That was it. End of story. It would have been
shot. He could have shot it in high enough definition in 16:9 to have a perfectly good shot in 4:3.
Yeah, but
he could have done shoot and protect the way I was taught to as a bloody cadet.
But you would have had to
decades
then,
ago.
It's not the resolution. It would have then changed. He would have had to be pan and scanning to choose.
No, you don't. That's the point. He would have been the protected part. His 4:3 cut would have been exactly what I used to shoot in my videos that I shot that were sometimes going to be on an old-fashioned television and sometimes going to be on a 16:9 screen. Mm. He could have shot it so that his 4:3 was what he was mainly concerned about and set up with, but then had the extra stuff on the outside for when it came to home video. It would have been very easy for him to do this and to still have his vision, to still have it 4:3 in the big cinemas, but also have it wider screen. Because the black bars just shit me to tears. There's a whole television there. And look, the thing is, I've A-B'd it. I have taken movies that have come to me in cinema 1.78:1 or whatever the various versions of that are, and I've cut them to 16:9 and sat there with them playing on two different things and A-B'd them. So I did that to Star Wars Episode 7.
Right.
Is I had it playing on two devices. One which was in the cinema cut with the black bars top and bottom, and one which was cut for 16:9. The 16:9 one is 100% more impact and more enjoyable. There is no doubt about it. There is just more light hitting your eyes. There's more action in front of you.
You still haven't convinced me on what the black bars do. Because
you're not using the screen to its full potential. It's like saying, oh, we'll just put it in the left speaker. That's my artistic choice. I'm just going to put it in the left speaker. That's all.
Okay.
And then people are listening to it in mono. It'll be fantastic. They'll get my original vision. But if you're listening in stereo, you're going, why the hell is this not in both ears?
Okay, that would be a poor artistic choice, but yeah, I would argue it's an artistic choice.
It's an artistic choice, but it's a dumb one. And I think doing something in 4:3 without shooting for the rest is a dumb choice.
Back last century.
It's not looking at where it's going to be in the end.
So back last century when TVs were 4:3, did you rage about the fact that they should be wider? Did you actually say, why aren't they wider? It's really frustrating.
Yeah, look, I did. And this happens now on Facebook particularly. When Facebook put a video up that's on a shot from a TV show. So, for example, I'm a fan of the Graham Norton show.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the time they're showing Graham at one end of the screen and one of his guests at the other. And when it's cut down into the square, as they like to do for all social media now, you're only getting the tips of their noses on the screen.
Yeah, but I'm saying, back in the day?
So back in the day, yeah, I used to watch those movies on the screen and you could be annoyed by the fact that clearly it wasn't working as well as it did when you were able to see everything. He could have had his exact vision and made it a full screen experience on a 16:9 TV. The simplest thing I'll say about it, Andrew, is that no TV network broadcasts in cinema cut in 1.78. If you're watching something on Channel 9 or Channel 10 or whatever on the television and you're seeing a movie, you get the Blu-ray home and it's in the cinema cut 1:78, so you've got black bars.
Yeah.
But as soon as they're broadcasting it on the television, it's the full screen. Every television network broadcasts to the full screen because you'd be mad to do anything else.
So your argument is that you're backed up by commercial television stations.
Well, I'm backed up by pretty much every television station, except, I guess, in this case, HBO Max.
Very nice. So have you ever seen The Dark Knight Rises on Blu-ray?
I have.
The aspect ratio changes those scenes.
That he shot in IMAX.
When Nolan went to IMAX. I think that works really well. Did you walk out for those scenes and come back when it was over?
No, but interestingly, Andrew, at one point around when that came out, or I think I got the box set of the three, I think, around when I got what is my current surround sound system and television, which is a decade ago now. But I used to like showing off the surround sound to people.
Mm-hmm.
Because some people who have never had it don't quite get the impact of how good surround sound is.
Correct.
The scene I would show them is the scene shot in IMAX where he's gliding through the streets of Hong Kong and yep. shooting bombs onto a building, because that is all shot in IMAX. I don't show them the cinema cut stuff with the black bars on top and bottom because it just does not have the impact. It does not have the joy that full screen experience does have.
But I just mean that when the movie changes and you get black bars because the Blu-ray changes the aspect ratio.
You have black bars through most of it and then you have a 15 minutes, I think, where you don't have black bars, where it goes to the full screen.
And you have, are those black bars acceptable?
No, the full screen part, like I was saying, when I show it off, I show people off the full screen part because that is much more exciting.
So you're only allowed to watch those parts from now on. You're not allowed to watch any of the other bits of
the
movie.
I'm allowed to watch them and have them shit me to tears, Andrew. That's perfectly acceptable.
Actually, that is more acceptable to me, to be quite honest. So we're never going to agree on this one, clearly, but that's okay because I don't mind being right. It's fine. I guess the main thing about the Snyder Cut is that it's very rare for you to get a big Hollywood studio film and to actually see a completely unfiltered vision of a single creator. I mean, that is relatively rare because, yes, sure, you know, when you go and see a Coen Brothers film or a Kevin Smith film or whatever, you know that you're getting exactly what they want because that's their thing. But a big blockbuster, $300-400 million film, it's incredibly rare to get the absolute unfiltered, unedited.
To have it auteured.
Yeah, totally. And so I think that this film, I didn't care about any of the flaws in the film, and there aren't really that many, because it was just such a wonderful study in film to actually see. You know,
I think it's been a great example of that because the studio had a look at what a horrible mess it was when 20 different people had a finger in that pie.
Yep.
And then the big demand came out for release the Snyder Cut. And suddenly it was like, maybe that will be better. And there's certainly an audience for that.
Correct. And look, they had the experience with Suicide Squad, where it was just a hot mess of a film because it was effectively two films mashed together.
Are we ever going to get the David Ayer cut?
Well, here's the irony, is that it's made. He made it. There would be virtually no cost to them to release that. And yet what do we believe coming out of Warner Brothers? But they've already come out and said, no, forget that. That hashtag can go away. But remember, he presented them with his cut of the film. It was finished.
I wonder if Ayer could please, David Ayer, please put it on a torrent site.
Yeah. Yeah, just do the whole, just leak it like Ryan Reynolds did with the Deadpool scene on the bridge.
On the bridge, yeah.
And the funny thing is, this keeps happening to Zack Snyder. Like, the ultimate edition of Watchmen was so much more satisfying than the theatrical release. And, oh my God, the director's cut of Batman v Superman actually made sense. And it was only half an hour longer. It just happened to be half an hour of really, really important stuff to the storyline. You know, I still maintain that the edit, the theatrical cut of Batman v Superman is one of the most bizarre things ever released. That they told him to edit for time, and whether he or someone else decided to just mess with our shit and take out 30 really important minutes. Because, I don't know if you've seen both together, but the narrative of that film makes so much more sense when you watch and that shouldn't be the case. A director's cut should be maybe more satisfying, or maybe have some things that were cut for time and that sort of thing, but it shouldn't actually make more sense. That means your original version's wrong. So this is a film that I think it's unique. I'm glad it exists. I'm probably going to go and watch it again tonight, because that'll be an even 24 hours of my life that I've spent with Mr. Snyder, and I'm glad I am.